A soldier in a machine gun.
That's part of the death.
I don't know.
That's the Lego collection that I've been making. All Legos that end up here, if it's a person, they end up there.
So they're part of the church services. Welcome. Welcome to third round of Dueling Pastors, which we got to come up with a different name for this because we're not dueling. And as you all know, I don't like Rod, according to his last message. So anyway, so we should have a lot of good cuts.
Cuts.
Yeah, well, I noticed that your congregation wasn't here today. They all left after yesterday. So you talked about friendship. They had nothing.
I sent them out. That's what they're doing. They're out.
But my congregation came.
I see.
Whoever my brother brings, that's my congregation. I don't have anybody else.
So it's really Joel's congregation.
Yeah, it's Joel's congregation. Anyway, let's pray. Dear Lord, I just thank you so much for the opportunity to come before you and to worship you, to speak your words, to wrestle with your words. And so, Lord, tonight as we wrestle with 1 Samuel 20, that as a community we would come to the truth that you want us to and that we would be touched by your Holy Spirit. And we ask all this in your name. Amen. A quick, I guess you would call it, station break. The computer may crash at any moment and cause a loud beeping sound due to the fact that PowerPoint is having some font problems. And it thinks that there are fonts that aren't there. So anyway, just hold your ears when it pops and presentations may freeze in the middle. But that's okay.
Wow. Now I'm nervous. I wasn't before. But
So anyway, we're in 1 Samuel 20. And I have a couple questions to open up tonight with, but I have to open my journal to ask you those questions. So if you give me a second, Rod, and just sort of fill some time for me.
No, I'm just gonna let you hang out there and look silly.
Yeah, I'm just trying to test your friendship.
Hey. Friends tell the truth.
Okay, well, I have three questions for you guys to think about, kind of more rhetorical than, I don't want you to answer them just yet. So anyway, the first one is, how much are you willing to risk to do what's right? Dennis. What is friendship? And how easily does your selfishness override your love for others? I want you to ponder those as we start reading 1 Samuel 20.
David and Jonathan says, then David fled from Naioth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, what have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to take my life? David's been looking back, and he sees all this stuff that's happened. Saul's throwing spears at him. Some really hinky stuff has gone on. And so he's asking Jonathan, Saul's son, what's going on here? Never, Jonathan replied. You are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It is not so. It's not so. But David took an oath, you know, that, oh yeah, well, here's an oath. You know, an oath really, your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said to himself, Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives, we heard that the previous chapter or two chapters ago, whenever that was, we heard that vow that you take. Saul said, as surely as the Lord lives, which is the ultimate vow. It's the testimony of, if I say, as surely as the Lord lives, it's the truth. Anything that comes out of my mouth after that is the truth. So he says, yet surely as the Lord lives and as you live. So he's staking not only God, but his friendship with Jonathan on this. There is only one step between me and death. And you know, if you think about it, that's been true so far. I mean, when a guy's hurling a spear at you, and Saul misses a lot, so I'm not quite sure what that's all about. But the interesting thing here that struck me was that David has been an intimate of Saul. He has been almost part, well, he is part of the family. He's one of the in-laws. He's married Saul's daughter. He and Jonathan are friends. He's in the family, and he has spent time from his youth with Saul. So he should really know Saul pretty well by now. And so does Jonathan know his father. Obviously, he's grown up in the house. And yet they have two completely different views of their dad, of this father figure. Which strikes me because I just went through that. I've been examining my relationship with my father, and part of going through this thing called Potter's Wheel and being counseled and talked to, you realize the huge impact that your father has on you and how you relate to your father. So I'm writing this thing to my older sister, Miriam, and I'm writing this wonderful missive about my experience of our dad growing up. For those of you who don't know, which, you know, Eric's whole congregation tonight.
I don't know who they are, though.
David, when we grew up, my dad died when I was 16. He was 42. My older sister was 18, I believe, at the time. And so, you know, I wrote kind of my experience of that time when my dad died and then my experience of him before. And I wrote this in an email to my sister, and it was just part of a casual, one of those casual emails, you know, that you send off. You have to write your family every once in a while to pretend that you care, and they write back pretending they care. But in reality, I was just writing information, just data, things I was going through. And a couple weeks later, I get this letter back from my sister, and she is describing her relationship with my father, and I'm thinking, did we grow up in the same house? Because your experience of my dad and my experience of my dad are like, you know, completely opposite. So I'm thinking, am I so screwed up that I do not see my dad honestly? I mean, that's the first thing, because, you know, we assume it must be me. I must be the stupid one. And so I'm writing my little sister saying, now, what was your experience of dad? And that was the third experience, you know. And it was a little, those parts of it were similar to mine. And I'm going, you know, okay, I'm good there, but I'm still weird over here. And then I talked to my brother, and we got number four, you know, four different experiences. We all grew up in the same house. We were, you know, we all lived there our entire lives, but at different times, different places, we all experienced dad differently. And we all have things that now shape our lives based on our perception of dad, which is a hint to you guys that are dads. You are screwing up your children.
And,
for those of us who are, or already have, you know, it is really amazing to me how you can live in the same place and have completely different perspectives. And that's kind of what you have here with Dave and Jonathan. You have this two sons, in reality, looking at the same person, and one's going, he's trying to kill me, I'm a step away from death. And the other one's saying, no, that's not my dad. He would never do that. He's that's not his way. And completely, and yet it also tells something about the character of Saul, that he is a completely different person too. We're multiple personalities, apparently. And I think that's what you see in Saul. We talked last time a little bit about his constant struggle with himself. You know, the vow that I'm going, as the Lord lives, David's not going to be put to death. And then, you know, a few verses later, he's heaving a spear at him. So we're conflicted people, and you see that that conflict raging in Saul.
Yeah, and Keith and I today were talking about the power of perception of children, and I was remembering when I was a little kid, I think like 2 and a half, my parents were laying carpet in their house, and I remember standing at the end of the door at the entryway, and I thought, gosh, I don't know how they make it all the way across this room. And then when I visited that room, it was like 4 steps for me as an adult. But as a 2-year-old, everything seems bigger than it is, and our perceptions are changed. And I was thinking, you guys, how do you think your children perceive you? I mean, what are some of the good things? What are some of the bad things? And also, maybe some short stories about what your perception of your parents, or how you've maybe seen things wrong in a situation because of the filter you were looking through. Jeff?
Interesting, because you know we have 3 kids and we have 3 different personalities looking at us through those eyes. And Caleb's like the sensitive one, so I'm always the mean guy, causing him to cry. But Daniel can't even focus long enough to even see me. So it's like, you know, it's just very it's just their perspective is different of the same thing I'm doing with all 3 of them. So.
Now what about Kelly?
Daddy's girl.
what's adding to the equation is it's not that they're all at different stages. Mm-hmm. They're at those stages, experiencing me at my stage right now. So I was, you know, are you the oldest?
Second
oldest.
Number 2.
You know, each one of you experienced your dad when he was at a different age than you were at the age you were at.
But I think you're right, and you know, my sister is 6'4" tall, which is really, and particularly back in that day, was really hard. And we were very poor, so she was wearing hand-me-downs. You know what kind of hand-me-downs you get when you're 6'4" tall? You know, they don't fit. So clothing didn't fit. So her perception of our whole growing up was, you know, shame and embarrassment and being hideous looking, and you know, so her perceptions got transferred onto that relationship too. And whereas a guy, you know, jeans and a t-shirt, you're pretty much covered no matter what, and they make those in really big sizes and small sizes, so it doesn't, you know, the whole dress thing was not a big deal to me. To my sister it was huge, you know. And so I think sometimes you're right. It's both, the sin is both ways. You know, it's not just the sins of the father that's visited to the 3rd and 4th generation, as Scripture says, but that the sins of the children also, the perceptions, the lies that we believe because of what we see.
Yeah. So moving on in our story, I think it's also very interesting to look at David and Jonathan. As I mean, if I were David at this point, I would be depressed. And I think depression does, in a sense, filter what your perception of reality is. And so David is vowing, and in some senses he's, you know, he's swearing and saying, yes, this is what your father really thinks. And Jonathan's like, no. I have a better grasp on reality. But their friendship is what pulls Jonathan over to believe what David says. And so in verse 4 it says, "Then Jonathan said to David, 'Whatever you say, I will do for you.' So David said to Jonathan, 'Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the 3rd evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. If he says, "It is good, your servant shall be safe," but if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is any iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? And Jonathan said, "Far be it from you, for I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you. Then would I not tell you about it?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers harshly?" And Jonathan said to David, "Come and let us go out into the field." So both of them went out into the field. So Jonathan and David kind of have this discussion about basically their mutual father, because David has kind of left his own family to live in the palace of sorts. And this new moon festival is something that the Jews had every single month. And it really is a gathering of family. If you look at Numbers 10, I believe, or is it 28? Yes, Numbers 28. You get a description of it, if you could read that. 11 through 15.
Yeah. "On the first day of each month, present to the Lord a burnt offering of 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, a year old, all without defect. With each bull there is to be a grain offering of some amount of fine flour mixed with oil. With the ram, a grain offering of some more stuff, and then some more offering. This is a burnt offering, a pleasing aroma, an offering made to the Lord by fire. With each bull there is to be a drink offering of a half a hin of wine, with the ram a third of a hin, and with each lamb a quarter of a hin. This is a monthly burnt offering to be made at each new moon during the year. Beside the regular burnt offering, with its drink offerings, 1 male goat is to be presented to the Lord as a sin offering." So
this is a place of community. This is a place when what's built into the Jewish faith is a time to come together and go back to your family. Only David is torn between the two, because he has his new family, the king, and Jonathan, and his old family. And so it provides an opportunity for David to escape for his life. But there's this idea of community that Rod had wanted to talk about, so I'm going to throw that at you.
But you have to start it, because I am lost.
You're lost?
Yeah.
Okay. The idea that Rod told me as we were sitting over coffee, that anytime that he can hit on a value at the village, he will. And one of our values is community. And the value of community, and really also the value that community brings, a sense of reality. Because David is in a place where reality is confused, and going home will bring him reality. And does that help you in any?
No.
No.
Okay. I'm still lost.
Well,
but it must have been a good conversation, because it had a great impact on you. It's just gone.
Right over your head.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe if I put my hair in the ponytail again. I don't know.
Why don't you do that?
Squeezes, yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. This is why dueling pastors is great, because it's good. We're both lost. Go ahead.
The whole, I think what I see in this monthly event is that it really was about family. You were expected to be around your home. You were expected to be around the people you loved, the people you were closest to. And that David now has this adopted community, that is the real nature of friendship. That friendship is community. You can't separate friendship and community. Friendship is a kind of a hard concept for me. It's a depth of loyalty and love and compassion towards each other, but it's also that other side that is willing to speak truth and wants the person to be better than they are. You know, that you want more. You want more for the person you're talking to than you want for yourself. Matter of fact, real friendship is not wanting something for yourself, but wanting everything for the person you're sharing your life with. One of the things we often do is, well, I was just speaking the truth. I was just telling him the truth. Well, yeah, but he's crushed. Yeah, but I was just telling him the truth. I think a lot of times we ought not to tell the truth unless we can say it in love. And love wants more for the other person than it ever wants for itself. Matter of fact, it's sacrificial to the point of it will sacrifice everything for the other person.
And I know, just to interrupt you, but I know where you were going with the community thing that I remember. And it was the community here at the Village, really, I think, were made up of two people, Jonathan and David. And most of us as individuals, I'll just say it, are either depressed or are walking alongside people who are depressed. And a lot of us rotate back and forth. Sometimes we're David and sometimes we're Jonathan. And really what I want you to do is look at David as an oppressed person, in the sense that David is so desperate and he knows that Saul wants to kill him, that if there's something that he's done wrong or he's going to have to come in, he'd rather have Jonathan kill him than to have Saul kill him. There's such an intense fear for his life that it is shaping his reality. And we have talked a lot about, as we've walked through Samuel, a lot about how David seemed to just sort of aimlessly walk through this whole thing where Saul's throwing things at him, trying to kill him, and he doesn't seem to get it. But I think all of a sudden, this whole gigantic ball of blackness called Saul has just dropped on top of David. And so my question, when I was asking those questions about friendship, and as we talk about community, is when I ask, what are you willing to risk? As we watch this story unfold, we're going to see that Jonathan is willing to risk his entire kingdom, being king, to save David. And the question I guess I would ask you, those of you who are walking alongside people who are depressed, how much are you willing to give to reach a hand out to them and pull them out? How much are you willing to lose to do that? What you value, the way people look at you. The other thing is, if you're David, the question is, who are you willing to reach out of your depression and find Jonathan? Because Jonathan isn't completely pursuing David. David is reaching out to him. And so as we talk about community, that really is the picture. We use that segue of David going back to his family and the value of community. But really, this here is our family. And the question as you look around is, how much are you willing to risk for the people, your friends, and vice versa? If you're struggling and you feel oppressed, are you willing to reach out and ask somebody for help?
I told you all that on Thursday
morning.
Yes,
you did.
Wow.
You did.
That's good stuff.
Thanks.
That is true. And I, that whole wrestling with who we are, at any given time, we are one of the two. That's amazing stuff.
Verse 12.
Jonathan said to David, "By the Lord, the God of Israel, I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he is favorably disposed toward you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away safely," which is exactly what Eric was, "I'll risk it all. May God deal severely with me. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father," which I wasn't sure if that was a curse or a blessing.
But it hasn't been all great for Saul.
Clearly, in the beginning, God was with Saul. And Saul, we've talked about Saul prophesying. We've talked about Saul being in God treating him graciously and lovingly and compassionately and helping him to win great battles. But Saul has clearly turned away. So even there you see that hint that David, or that Jonathan, is not condemning God in this. He's recognizing where the sin is in his father. "But show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord call David's enemies to account." And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. It's interesting that Jonathan says, "May the Lord call David's enemies to account." David doesn't have enemies. He has an enemy. One, Saul. So he's saying, call dad to account, yeah, is what Jonathan's saying. God, deal with my dad.
And this, I mean, though, just to jump back to the covenant between David and
right,
Jonathan, loving kindness is the Hebrew word for mercy that God has for us, the binding mercy. And so this whole chapter, this whole part here just blows me away, because here's Jonathan not only saying basically God punished my dad because he's not doing the right thing, and when all of your enemies get wiped out, meaning me or, you know, my family, please be kind to me, still look on me with this covenant, with this loyalty, and with this promise. And so my question to you guys is, and this isn't rhetorical, has anyone ever done, well, probably not that drastic for you, but what are some instances in your life where somebody has stepped in the gap and said, you know, risked a lot for you to be where you're at right now? Does anybody, you know, it can be a semi-long story if you want. Does anybody, Rod?
I'm going to go ahead and tell this, if I may. You. Yeah.
I don't know where you're at.
Stop him and whenever.
Fasting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Past Tuesday, I fasted for you, which was interesting for me, because I have fasted for the community before, and I have fasted for myself before, but I have never fasted for individuals before and prayed just specifically for you. And as I was doing that, I knew you were struggling, wanting to quit smoking, and that was your thing that you're wanting us to join in with you on. And I'm sitting in my office, and there's a desk drawer in my office. Now, I am, for the first time in my life, fasting. I am starving to death. I am so hungry. I am just dying to go eat. And I cannot go eat because I have vowed to fast. And I open this desk drawer in my desk that I never open, and there's this huge bag of pretzels in there. And it was just killing me, you know? And I thought, you know what? I need to take those pretzels and go give them to somebody, get them out of my office so that I will not be tempted, because I know me, and I know that I'll give in. And it was just killing me. I mean, it was absolutely killing me. And I thought, when I thought to do that, then I thought, you know what? That's what you're going through today. This desire to do this thing. And if I don't resist this temptation on your behalf, then I haven't done my job. I know it's a really tiny thing. It's not anything huge and valuable. But all, you know, then I finally got the whole resisting the temptation of the pretzels thing. And then I'm the only one who's on staff at Teen Challenge that night. And so I have to go monitor the meal. And they have this huge dinner, and they have extra people that came. And I have to go sit in this cafeteria with 25 people all chowing down on this wonderful food, smells, you know. And when I called you and you said, "I made it through the day, I didn't smoke," I went, yes. Laying down something of value, my desire to eat, for a friend.
Cool. Anybody else? Anybody else have a story like that they want to tell? Julie?
Mine's more about me. I was the one struggling at the time, but I remember why I stopped drinking when I was 16. And then when I was in college and came in contact with believers who drink, decided, oh, it's okay. And so then I proceeded to start drinking and having a problem with alcohol. And my roommate, like one night I had just drank some of their alcohol and they just had it around the house. My roommate was like, she never in her life has had more than two drinks. That's like, she's been drinking since she was in high school and always limited herself to two drinks. Not a problem for her, you know. But she came home and I talked to her about the struggle that I was having, and she dumped out all the alcohol in the house that, you know, it was all her stuff. And she said, I don't have to drink, you know. It's not that I have a problem with it, but if it will help you, I won't drink. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of humiliating at the time, but in retrospect, it was a very cool, gracious act of love.
Cool. One more. Don't have to be one more, but if somebody wants.
I feel ashamed that I don't get everything done, but I think I should get done. I think maybe I should have tried harder or could have figured out a way to do it better. And today I asked four of my friends to come and do some of their work for me for 1 hour.
Cool. I bet you got four times the amount of work done. Cool. So our story continues, and what verse are we on?
Well, I'd like to go back to that verse 17, where Jonathan and David David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself, and which is the great commandment. Whereas, you know, the first commandment that Jesus leaves with us after fulfilling the law is that we should love God above all, and the second commandment, which he says is just like the first commandment, which is that we should love our neighbor as ourselves, and I guess. Purest form, that's what real love, that's what God calls us all to, is. And I think it's interesting about the whole reaffirming the oath, and you talked about that. We assume friendships a lot, and we just assume that they go on, and we don't take those acts of reaffirming our vows. I'm supposed to do a reaffirmation of vows for a couple, some friends of mine, coming up in August. They want to reaffirm their vows as married people. I think it might be good for all of us to reaffirm our vows on occasion, to be friends to each other, to maintain that friendship. We forget that. We just, you know, it happens in marriages, it certainly happens in friendships, where we just assume that person is going to be there, and there's nothing here that says they have to.
I think the shocking part about this is that Dave and Jonathan continually talk about their friendship. And I was going through my closet the other day, and I pulled out one of my wife's old journals, and I was reading it. She has a whole stack of journals. And I almost brought the journal and read it. Xerox. But I ran across this time when Susan and I and two of our friends were at coffee, etc. And what we did was we said, okay, each person has 15 or 20 minutes, and they have to tell the other person, so three people telling one other person, everything they like about them. And so then my wife, who's meticulous about these things, wrote it all down. So I had, like, you know, what she thought of me right when we were first dating and all that cool stuff. But it was something really interesting and unique to our friendship, is that we told each other, a lot of my friends, I mean, we're sort of, I don't know, weird, we'd sit around at coffee shops and tell each other how much we liked each other. but there was a sense that we were affirming for one another the value. And so when somebody asked me, well, why does Kurt like you? Well, I had like 3 pages I could like read if I needed to remember. But I knew because he told me. And I think that's something that we don't do. And I think we should do it on a regular basis and say, hey, this is why I like you. It's a hard exercise sometimes, you know, even if you really like the person, to come up with a concrete way of expressing it to them. So anyway, before this goes like 2 hours long, unless you have a comment.
Nope.
The story, just to kind of narrate a little bit, because there's this huge long passage in the next verses that David and Jonathan figure out this plan. The plan is basically, okay, you go to the festival with your dad, Jonathan. If he says something about me not being there, then, you know, and that he's mad and he wants to kill me, then you'll tell me. And the way you're going to do it is you're going to hide in, I'm going to hide in this cave. Then you're going to go out and you're going to shoot these arrows on one side of the stone, and that means one thing. And then if you shoot the arrows on the other side of the stone, then, you know, that means another thing. And it reminds me of like two little boys playing, okay, if mom says this, then what I want you to do is like run out the door screaming. If mom says this, then, you know, stay inside. It's just a silly plan. It doesn't make a lot of sense because they both know that Saul knows that Jonathan likes David, and if Jonathan leaves, he's going to send someone to follow him. And so it has to be, it's just like two boys being secretive. So anyway, that brings us all the way to verse 24. So it says, so David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. And the king sat on his seat, as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, he thought, it is an accident. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. And it came about the next day, the second day of a new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal either yesterday or today? Jonathan then answered Saul, David earnestly asked me to leave to go to Bethlehem. For he said, please let me go, since our family has sacrificed in the city and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away that I may see my brother. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now, send and bring him to me, for he must surely die. But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put him to death.
This part is the part that blows me away. But a couple things that I just notice. One is that when our anger rules and when we let go of all constraints, notice how we no longer call people by their names. We, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. You know, this is Jonathan. He has a name, you know. But Saul is so angry that he will no longer use his name. And then he says, that son of Jesse. He won't use David's name. And I found that true in my own life, that when I am really angry with someone, I begin to describe them rather than use their name. And maybe one of the tests for us as we deal with our anger issues and as we deal with it is, who are you describing rather than calling by name? Mm-hmm. Who in your life has become that person that you describe rather than whose name you use? that may point us to the people that we really have difficulty with. It's cultural too. You know, we give whole classes of people and whole groups of people, and you know, when we're at war, we you know, the Germans were Krauts, and the Vietnamese were, what were they?
Kooks.
It's, you know, it's just amazing how we can do that. We have that capacity to use descriptors out of our anger. It's also interesting to me that what Saul is really accusing Jonathan of is not being his son. He's saying, "You're not my kid. Because if you were my kid, you would side with me. You don't. You're not my child." He's questioning whether, you know, you must be the son of a milkman because you're not, you know, you're not my son, or you would not do this to me. Then the other fascinating thing to me is that there's no pretense at all in Saul anymore. Bring him to me, for he must die. We have finally, you know, we've gone the far extreme of this rage against David. And then I love Jonathan. I mean, the description of Jonathan here. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. After Saul throws a spear at him, he figures out that maybe he's trying to kill David. I mean, it's like he's trying to kill everybody. He's trying to kill you. He's trying to kill David. This is no longer about Saul's... it's not specific to David any longer. This is a man who rage has finally completely taken over. And he is not just angry with David. He is angry with David, Jonathan, life. He is miserable. And that downward spiral, I think, is completed when we so hate all of life, everyone around us, everything. We point fingers at everything. And you really see that in Saul at the bottom of the spiral.
And I think the interesting thing about Jonathan is that Jonathan believes David, but you realize that he didn't completely believe him. And if you have ever spent any time with us here at the village, sometimes when you're talking to somebody who's depressed or struggling, it's very difficult to believe them. It's like, why can't you just snap out of it? And so there is a sense of in the back of your head. And I think finally at this point, when Jonathan gets the spear hurled at him, reality sinks in. Reality is like, oh, okay, so David really is onto something here. And also the grief and the sadness, because he realizes that now the implications of what David has been talking about are now into full force. They're going to just, everything's going to happen, and this is probably going to be the last time he's going to see David.
And but Jonathan gets up from the table in fierce anger, that there's this righteous anger. And the contrast of the realization that Jonathan has is that, wow, David's right. He's been right all along. And now he is outraged at what his father's done. And that contrast between the insane anger of Saul and the righteous anger of Jonathan, I think, is an interesting picture there too. I'd like to just skip ahead, because at this point they go out there and they play out this game that they had devised earlier of shooting arrows, and then after they shoot the arrows, which says you need to run, then Jonathan goes out to meet him anyway. So I'm not sure what the point of the game was. If I shoot the arrows on this side of the rock, then you have to run for your life and don't come back. So he shoots the arrows on that side of the rock, and then they go get together. So
and they send their servant away.
And then they send the kid away.
Right. Yeah. Take the weapons.
Yeah, go take the weapons. Which is a sign of that relationship too, because they are now weaponless. They are. It is true friendship. They can't wound each other. After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. And I know that you had some stuff to talk about on that.
Well, I mean, I think other people, well, I think I can speak some to this, but I mean, I think David, more than even Jonathan, understands Jonathan's role in his life. I mean, this is the man who saved him, the man who saw past all of what his father, what Saul saw in him, and I don't know, it's just, the whole scene just kind of, it is a picture of friendship that I long for in people. It's a picture of friendship that I long for with Rod and with you guys. A place where I actually understand fully your role in my life. Where there's a way I grasp what you're doing and I don't know, it really blew me away.
And the beauty of this, I think, too, is that David had... Jonathan had the most to lose. I mean, at this point, he has lost his kingdom. His kingdom is no more. He recognizes fully that David is God's chosen, that and David, sensing the loss, you know, what Jonathan has sacrificed on his behalf, weeps more. I mean, that to me is the beauty of this particular of that image to me is once the person who's deeply depressed or who's going through the hard struggle or who's going through the tough time, our sympathies go out to them. But in the end, when we realize what people have sacrificed for us, wow, that's rich.
Which reminds me of a story
Uh-oh. That
I have about my childhood.
Uh-oh.
I mean, I was a wimpy kid, okay? I mean, I might be big and, you know, fat now, but...
Then.
I was a wimpy kid, and I lived in Miami Globe, Arizona, which is like the armpit of Arizona. My father was vice principal, and my brother liked it there. I did too, but I was in the second grade riding the bus home, and there were the fourth graders or fifth graders who also rode the bus, and there was this one particular fourth grader who liked to spit chew on me. And he decided, like, after a week that he was going to beat me up. And I had figured this out. And so what I learned was that you get people who are from fourth grade and you make them like you, and then they protect you. So I never, ever got in a fight, but there were many fights for me. But in this particular time, there was one second grader who was exceptionally large, big guy for a second grader in my class. And my fourth grade defender was not on the bus. So when I got off the bus, and the guy who spit chew on me got off the bus, so did my big, you know, hefty friend, and he got the snot beat out of him. Well, I ran for home. He stepped in and really got walloped. So I remember riding my bike up to his house, you know, and his whole face is just all puffy from, you know, being in this fight. And I was just like, I mean, I just wanted to cry. I was like, God. And he was like, oh, don't worry about it. Everything's okay. But I can understand where David was, because here was somebody who stood in the gap to, you know, get beat up. Well, then my big fourth grade friend the next day beat the crap out of the other guy, and somebody had to yank him off because he was, you know, pounding his head into the cement. So. Justice King. And they all did it for me.
Wow.
Don't live in Miami, Arizona. Unless you're Joel. But that...
Of course, he had a big brother to defend it, right? Joel did. So.
No, I just handcuffed him to the pole. Yeah, that's too defensive. But so I want to return back to the question that I asked you guys. And really... I like giving assignments, and so tonight the assignment is this: that I want you to sit with different people here in this community and those who, you know, are part of my congregation, and
but not mine,
but not yours, and I want you to tell each other, you know, what you like about them, give them some context for them to say, you know, this is why Karen likes me, and. So I would like to hear that conversation as we're eating pizza and stuff. And secondly, I really do this week want you to think, you know, am I really willing to give up what I value for somebody else? Am I really willing to stand in between Saul and David and be that person? So those are my questions for you guys to wrestle with tonight. Do you have anything you would like to add to that?
Yeah, what do you like about me? You
know. Oh. Well, you know, I conveniently realized that there was no communion bread last week during your message, and so I left. So I have no idea what you talked about.
See,
but I hear you were talking about me.
Last week I said what I liked about you, and I was kind of hoping that this week.
Yeah. Well,
I've got time. I know they don't, but I've got time.
Well, I like that you hug me. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this community, and I thank you that they let us experiment with different things as we talk about your word. Lord, I thank you that you have given us community to walk along in a world that's fallen, in a world that's hard, and to offer our lives as sacrifices for survival of one another. And so I just ask that as we worship you and as we spend time taking communion and singing, that you would really drive home those truths in our life. And ask all these things in your name, Jesus. Amen. Couple ways to respond. There's offering baskets next to Rod, next to the community.